welcome to another edition of Five of the Best. This one is going to be about Showman. There's going to be pictures on the website at fiveofthebest@podomatic.com. Okay. The next Showman I'm going to talk about is William Kobe, William, or better known as Buffalo Bill. William was born in 1846 in Toronto, Canada, and but the family moved to Philadelphia soon after. And his father was a landowner, and in fact, Isaac Kobe was totally against the slave trade. And he often went to slave markets and set up a stall and preached against slavery. And this angered the people there so much that he actually got stabbed and almost lost his life at one of these markets. The Kobe family were always on the move because of Isaac Kobe's stance towards slavery, and in fact Isaac never really fully recovered from the stabbing incident, and he actually died when William was 11 years old. He became really the main breadwinner then, and he took up work with the railways. He became like a messenger boy, running the train, giving the platform staff messages. In the 1860s, with gold fever sweeping the country, a young 14-year-old Bill made his way to the gold fields. But on his way there, he stopped off at the Pony Express, in fact, earned a job as a Pony Express rider, setting a few records on the way. The Pony Express only lasted 18 months. And his next job of real interest was when he earned a contract to supply buffalo meat to the railways, which were spreading across the country. And he, in fact, made $500 a month. And this is such where he earned his name, Buffalo Bill. He killed 11 buffalo with 12 shots. In fact, the way he shot or hunted the buffalo, he was on horseback, and he used to ride alongside the buffalo, and he used to shoot them with a handgun or with a rifle while on horseback. When Buffalo Bill was hunting buffalo, it was in a sustained way, and it was with a purpose. But with increases in technology of the guns, and with the buffalo hide being used in many other things like coats and shoes, the real slaughter of the buffalo took place. These hunters used high-powered rifles and just stood in the field and just shot them. From 1870, there was an estimated 50 million buffalo. 18 years later, there was less than 1,000. For the Indians, they used the buffalo as a food source, and to see that one of their food sources just decimated obviously caused them a lot of friction, and they just saw the buffalo being shot, stripped, the carcasses left to rot, and the hide just sold for 25 cents a hide. And this led to a number of fracas between them and the Indians, quite understandably, really. But back to Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill, during the Civil War, he actually started to work as a scout and was a trusted scout for Price and General Custer. It's about this time that fictional authors started to use the name Buffalo Bill in fictional books, and this is where a lot of the myths came about with Buffalo Bill. But he became a celebrity, and on a visit to New York, he was persuaded to go on stage and got a rapturous applause. And this led to him taking up an acting career in New York, and a successful acting career as well. But he did return to the Wild West after his friend General Custer had been massacred at Little Bighorn. The U.S. wanted retribution, and it was in fact a Buffalo Bill who actually found the Cheyenne, and he stalked and killed the outpost and then waved the sages through for the attack. And this just brought even more fame for Buffalo Bill. By 1883, Buffalo Bill, or William Kobe, decided to set up his first Wild West show. And this was a huge success right from the get-go. And it did show a very romantic view of the Wild West, and that there were Indians and Indian chiefs, in fact, took part. And it was a hit for over 30 years. And just example how successful it was. In 1892, over 190 days, they performed 132 shows. And this with a cast of 600 people, 400 horses, and 20 buffalo. So just the logistics of getting from one place to another is quite an achievement. And over 30 years, he performed to over 17 million people. So I think it deserves him. The next showman I'm going to talk about is P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum, some say that he was a scam artist or a freak show owner, and asked what his personal aims were. He said, well, to put as much money into his own coffers. P.T. Barnum was born in 1810, and in his early life was as a storekeeper. And it's here that he claimed he had several businesses. One which was definitely, he was involved, well, was with a state lottery. 1834 was not a good year for young Phileas Taylor Barnum. He spent a stint in prison for libelling the church and a vicar, and while he was in prison, he found that his main source of income, which was the state lottery, had been banned. Not one being down for long, he actually purchased a black slave who was badly blind and badly disabled, and he claimed that she was in fact George Washington's nurse and at least 160 years old. He exhibited her at fairs and other attractions, and in fact the slave, which was Joyce Heath, died 300 days after being purchased. But in the meantime, P.T. Barnum had her revenues were at least $1,500 a week. Buoyed on with this success, P.T. Barnum went round the fairs with such exhibits and exhibiting people such as the bearded lady, the fat man, and of course Tom Thumb. Tom Thumb was introduced to him when Tom Thumb, real name Charles Stratton, was introduced to P.T. Barnum when he was 5, yet he claimed to be 11. And by the time that Charles was 14, he was drinking, smoking, gambling. Sounds like a young boy's dream, really. And they were lifelong friends. And in 1941, he bought the Scholars Museum in New York and Broadway, and he filled it with what he claimed to be 500,000 exhibits from around the world, curiosities from around the world. Although a number of them were fake, and including the mermaid, which he bought from Calcutta for a lot of money. And all it was a monkey's body and sewed onto a fish's tail. And in the museum, he had a sign saying, "This way for the egress," and people went this way through the door and out, and had to come round and pay to get back in again, because egress is the Latin word for exit. I'm going to finish off with, as far as I'm concerned, one saving grace in his life, and that is when he went to Europe, he met opera singer Jenny Lund, who was a huge star in Europe, and known as the Swedish Nightingale. And he was impressed with her and offered her a contract to go to America, where she thought she was unknown. And she agreed for $1,000 for a 100-night tour. Upon reaching New York, she was greeted on the quayside with 40,000 people, and quickly realizing that she had been undersold, she renegotiated her contract with P.T. Barnum, and there was a more of 50-50 split, in which that she did the contract, and both of them made around £500,000 each, or dollars each. And after that, she continued her tour around America, and the thing of Jenny Lund is she gave everything, or half of everything she made, she gave to her own charity, for charities in Sweden. I could go on about P.T. Barnum and him purchasing Jumbo the Elephant from London Zoo, and him bringing him over and exhibiting him over in America. But the more I've read about this guy, the more I disliked him. There's people in the Traders Edition I admire more than this person. And I'm going to talk about someone who is the polar opposite to this guy, and that is Harry Houdini. Harry Houdini was born Eric Weitz in Budapest in 1874, and his family came over to America when he was 4 years old. And life was hard for him and his father. His father was an unemployed rabbi, and he struggled to support his wife and their 7 children. And this is when young, we'll call him Harry, as a young boy, he used to go out and do street theatre to bring money into the house. And he used to come home and tell his mum to shake him. And when his mum shook him, all the money came out. And it was this money, this sort of money, that his mother actually bought Harry a magic kit, and that is where the bug got him. Harry Houdini started to perform his magic tricks at local dime bars and local theatres with his brother Besh. And it was one of these local theatres that he actually met a young 18-year-old singer, Bess Rayner. And first, she was in fact dating his brother Besh, but Harry won her over and married her, and a lifelong partnership developed. And as they performed as the Houdinis, and he could easily escape handcuffs. That was one of his tricks. And so he started to advertise. He went to the papers and invited them down to the local police station, who would tie him up and he would escape. And this was just great free publicity for him. And it just buoyed his career up. Harry Houdini really became an escape artist, and he escaped from handcuffs and ropes, and then from multiple handcuffs, and then from straitjackets, and then from straitjackets suspended from a 10th story window. And in 1901, we saw the milk can escape, where he was placed, he was first handcuffed, and he'd be handcuffed and then sealed inside an oversized milk can. And the crowd would be asked to hold his breath, and he'd be sealed inside the milk can, and he would escape from that. I mean, Harry Houdini was an extremely fit guy. He was a champion cross-country runner in his youth. The progression of that trick led to the Chinese water torture, which was he was secured by his ankles in some stocks and then lowered into a tank full of water, and he would escape from that. The escapes he did were becoming more and more dangerous, and in 1912 he tried to perform a buried alive stunt, in which he was he put in a casket, buried 6 foot down with and covered up, and an hour and a half later his hand came out of the ground, but clearly it was not right. He was brought from the ground and spent some time in hospital recovering. In 1913, when he was 39, his mother died, and it was his mother who had supported him, who gave him the first magic kit, and was always there for him, and they were very close. And after her death, he started to go into seances to try and contact her. And as he saw more seances, he started to see the tricks they were using, and he became very upset, because a lot of people were going to these fraudulent spiritualists and taking desperate people's money. And he became very, very cynical of these spiritualists, and so much so that he went on a tour exposing them and showing the tricks of how they were doing it. And he spent over $1 million of his own money touring the country, trying to give people an informed decision as to these fraudulent spiritualists. And he became very popular with the general public. I'm going to move a little forward now until the 1918, and well into his 40s, and he started a film career. He did a number of films, and two very successful films, and a 15-part serial called The Master Mystery. You can see these. I'm going to put these on the website. A lot of these stuff. You could talk to him about him for ages. I'm going to talk a little about the man, though. All through his life, even in his prime, he used to go to hospitals and perform for children, in children's wards and for the sick. He used to turn up at hospitals unannounced and just do it. And he did this all the time, all through his career. And there's a story about when he came back home, he visited his home town, and he was approached and he said, "Oh, Mr. Houdini, thank you very much." "What for?" said Harry. "I haven't done anything." And he says, "Oh, but it's your charity that has helped keep the family together and put food on the table." And this is what he was like. As fast as he made it, he just gave it away to his own charities and other charities. And the little boy who helped his mum and the family was still there as a grown-up man. And that's, you can understand why people speak with him with such reverence today. I'm not going to talk about the myth of how he died. If you want to find how he did die, you can. I'm going to finish off with one of his tricks, which is a bit queasy. He's on stage in front of 9,000 people, and he invited people up to come up and stick needles into his face. And they stuck a grand total of 22 needles, at which time he then removed the needles and swallowed them. He then swallowed a thread, about a spool of thread, and then he pulled out the thread, and the needles then came on the thread attached, and no one knows how he did that today. The next showman I'm going to talk about evokes strong emotions in people. He's a bit like Marmite. You either love him or you hate him, and you probably already know it's David Blaine. David Blaine was born on the 4th of April 1973 in Brooklyn, New York, to a Puerto Rican father and a Russian mum. And as a young boy, a young child, he was interested in magic, and this was very much encouraged by his mum. And he liked to perform in front of people, and this brought an interest in acting. And he went to acting class after school, and through his acting, he went on to perform in some commercials and appeared in the soap opera OC. Still performing his magic tricks, it was in 1997 that he was brought to mainstream attention when he did a 45-minute documentary called David Blaine Street Magic, hosted by Leonardo DiCaprio. And a lot of the stuff is still on YouTube, and it's still very watchable. It was in 1999 that he did his first stunt. And it must be said at this stage that David Blaine is a huge fan of Harry Houdini. In fact, he grew up with Harry Houdini poster in his bedroom. And his first stunt was one that almost killed Harry Houdini, and that was buried alive. He spent 7 days in a plastic coffin with 3 tons of water on top of him. And this attracted 75,000 people. So. The following year, David Blaine did another stunt called Frozen in Time, and where David Blaine was encased in a block of ice, and he did this dressed solely in a boot and a pair of pants. The ice was transparent, so you can see him, and there was a tube supplying him with air and water. And he did this he stayed within it for 3 days, and after he left this, in fact, he claimed to have health problems. In 2002, he did yet another stunt called Vertigo, where he stood upon a pier which was 30 metres tall. He was not harnessed to the pier, but he did have 2 retractable handles in case it got windy, and he stayed on that for 35 hours. In 2002, he released his autobiography, and probably the most interesting thing about that was there was a riddle in the biography offering £100,000 for it to be solved. And after 16 months, an ex-teacher, or part-time teacher, Siri Stanks, found the prize under a rock in an LA property. She must have been happy when she found that. The next stunt he did was in 2003 in London, and it was called Above and Below. And the stunt involved him being suspended for 44 days, 9 metres above the ground, in a 2 metre square plexiglass box. This is better known in the UK as the Twat Dangle. The public grew more hostile to him as the days went on, and they started throwing eggs, sausages, paintballs, and people got their golf clubs out and golf balls and started firing golf balls at him. But after 24 days in the box, he actually lost 24 kilos, which is 25% of his body weight. And I don't know what he's like in the USA, but in the UK, he seems a bit of a clown, which is a bit unfair because he does a lot of work for charity. The last event I'm going to talk about happens in 2008, when he appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show and claimed that he was going to try and break the world record for the assisted static apnea, or holding your breath underwater. The rules state that you can actually breathe pure oxygen for half an hour before the attempt, and that's what he did. And in front of a studio audience, in front of TV cameras, he did actually go and set a new world record. He set a new record of 17 minutes and 4 seconds, which stood for 4 months. And today the world record stands at 22 minutes 22 seconds for the assisted and 11 minutes 35 for the non-assisted.